Welcome to On the Mic Podcast. This is your host, Tim Drake. On today's episode, I have comedian, actor, and podcaster Kevin Allison. Kevin is best known for his work on the hit cult classic MTV show, The State. I was so excited to have Kevin on the show. As many of you know, of course, I have a huge love for sketch comedy, and The State was a huge impact on me in my decision to eventually, you know, go through the writing program at Second City, start writing sketches, start filming sketches, and really just kind of dive into comedy. And it was really exciting to finally have Kevin on the show. Kevin also hosts the Risk podcast that has over 1 million downloads per month. So it is a huge podcast. It's had the likes of Mark Maron, Patton Oswalt, so many great comedians on the show. It's a storytelling podcast where people come on the show and kind of let their shields down, and, you know, are able to kind of express their vulnerability and tell stories that they wouldn't normally tell other people. It's an absolutely fantastic show that I highly suggest you check out. And throughout the episode, Kevin and I kind of talk about, you know, the art of podcasting and kind of how he developed this show and, you know, what he's learned from the show and learned from storytelling and you know, why he feels that's such an important element to the art, not just of podcasting, but the art of entertainment. It was really fun talking to Kevin about the show and getting ready. You know, he has two shows coming up this coming Saturday at Nerd Melt out in Los Angeles. So if any of you that are out in Los Angeles, get out to the show. It's going to be a fantastic show. You know, there'll be different storytellers there. And then here in Salt Lake City on December 12th at the Urban Lounge, Kevin will also be here doing the Risk podcast live. So they do a couple live shows every month in New York and Los Angeles. So I'm thrilled that they're coming here to Salt Lake City. And, you know, I think that there's going to be some fantastic storytellers. We've got a lot of great talent out here. And I think it's going to be great, a great addition to the Risk podcast. So make sure you go check those out, both at Nerd Melt this weekend, this Saturday, over at Meltdown, and then here in Salt Lake City, December 12th. All the information can be found on the Risk podcast website. All those links, of course, will be on our website, so you can check all that out and also be able to follow Kevin. And if you've never watched The State, you're absolutely missing out. You need to go find this. I know you can order the DVDs on Amazon. That's what I did several years ago when I was really diving into it. They're also available, a lot of them, for download and for streaming. You can find, you know, some of just the short sketches on YouTube. You've got to check it out. I mean, this is the show that not only brought us Kevin, but, you know, Michael Ian Black, Tom Lennon, Michael Showalter, David Wayne, so many great comedic actors. This entire show, it was just absolutely incredible. Before we let you go right into the episode, I have to tell all of you, happy Thanksgiving. Hope you guys have a fantastic holiday and a big kickoff, of course, to the holiday season. Be safe in all of your travels. Have fun with your family, if that's possible. So I know, you know, it can be hard sometimes having fun with family. For the first time in 8 years, I'm actually going to my family's place. So my wife and I have always gone over to her family. And it's kind of weird to the fact that, you know, as long as we've been married, we've actually never had Thanksgiving with my family. We usually do Christmas over there because her family kind of disperses during Christmas. And so it's always kind of, you know, been Thanksgiving there, Christmas with my family. And it's kind of weird to realize that since we've been married, we've never had Thanksgiving with my family. So I'm really excited about it, making some pies today. I don't know what kind of pies. More or less, I should say, I am supervising the making of pies. I don't think my wife would let me make pies. Not that I'm a bad cook at all, but it's her thing. I know there'll be some pumpkin pie, probably some amazing cheesecake. My brother insists on rhubarb pie. I'm not making that. He's making that. I won't eat it. It'll be for him. It's going to be his own pie. It's going to be fun. I'm really excited about it. I think we're even going to a movie. I think we're going to go see The Good Dinosaur, the new Pixar movie. It looks like a lot of fun. So, yeah, it should be a fun Thanksgiving. I usually kind of dread the day, but, yeah, it should be fun. Any of you guys that are going out Black Friday shopping, I hate Black Friday. I worked retail for years before, you know, starting the illustrious career of trying to make it an entertainment. So if you're going out Black Friday shopping, my word of advice, don't be a dick. Just be nice to other people. Guess what? They're just material items. Who cares about the deal? Just go out. I mean, if it's your thing, go out and have fun. But just treat other people right. You know, keep in mind, you know, you're celebrating Thanksgiving, things that you're thankful for. You know, don't be a dick about things. Just treat others with respect. Have fun and be safe this weekend. And while you're doing all of that, while you're waiting in line for those stores to open and to, you know, be able to grab those deals, Hey, look, you listen to the podcast now, so you're already on top of it. But tell your friends while they're wondering what else they could be doing while they're waiting in line. Tell them to download this episode and make sure, again, if you're in Los Angeles this weekend, hit up Meltdown. Go see Kevin Allison and the Risk Podcast live there. And of course, December 12th here at the Urban Lounge in Salt Lake City, Risk Podcast live with Kevin Allison. I really hope you guys enjoyed this episode. It was so much fun talking to Kevin. I learned so much from him during this podcast. And yeah, it was just a great, great episode. I had a lot of fun. Enjoy this episode with Kevin Allison. Excellent. Well, I'm excited to have you on. So when Sheila reached out to me about Risk coming to Salt Lake City, I was absolutely ecstatic.
Oh, that's awesome.
So now with Risk, I first came across Risk only about, I don't even know if it's been a year, when one of my friends had shown it to me. And I didn't realize you guys have been doing this show since 2009.
Yes. We're very fortunate, actually, to have started it in 2009, because that was kind of the choice moment to be starting a podcast. You know, it was just as podcasts were becoming really popular, but long enough before, you know, basically the way it's worked is that we started off with a very small following, but it has just very gradually grown and grown and grown. For the past, you know, we've just begun our seventh year. So we have absolutely no intentions of stopping anytime soon either. We feel that this will continue to grow and grow. Like, statistics are showing that people just continue to discover that podcasts are an amazing way to get remarkable content, you know, mostly for free. And advertisers are waking up more and more to this fact as well. So, you know, we're thrilled. We just want to keep chugging along, because it really changed my entire life and changed my career.
Yeah, as I was reading up on some of it, I read that, I mean, when you started it, I mean, you mentioned how it's changed your life, that you kind of started this as the result of a failure. What was it that had happened that kind of sparked the idea for the podcast?
Well, you know, I got my start in the sketch comedy group The State.
Of course.
We had a show on MTV in the 90s, and we thought we'd be around forever, like the Rolling Stones, but that just was not meant. And when The State broke up, my personality is, you know, I grew up the odd man out in my family, right? I was the black sheep, I was the middle child, I was the kid who's always off in his own universe.
I know that feeling all too well.
Yeah, my nickname was Space Cadet. So I, you know, it doesn't matter what group I'm in, I will become the outlier, because there's a lot of freedom and beauty in being the outlier. You know, in the state, it's true, I was out of the little clique that held most of the power in the group, but I could kind of go between this person and that and spend quality time with this little clique and then maybe write with some other people over here. I was very fluid that way. But as a result, I was also left out of a lot of stuff. You know, now in the storytelling world, Risk is an outlier. Like, I have never, ever been plugged into The Moth or, I just love creating a storytelling show that kind of has its own vibe, and that encourages people to try something a little bit different, to go where they might not go on another show. Long story short, to get back to where I was before, I much of an outlier then because I was afraid of a lot of the comedy community. I was dealing with a lot of social anxiety and stage fright and just had a hard time envisioning what it was I wanted to communicate and how. Because I really didn't feel like a stand-up comedian, you know? And it's hard to be a sketch comedian without a group. So for years, I really floundered. I never felt like I was good at auditioning. I always felt like a bit of a freak, like there are so many disparate parts of my personality, you know, where I'm too gay and raunchy and kinky in this area, and then I'm too friendly and spiritual and polite in this other area. You know, like, it's just too absurdist sometimes and yet too serious other times. So I've always felt like I'm not something that Hollywood executives, be they casting directors or, you know, executive producers, whatever, I always felt like those kind of people just couldn't find a round hole for a square peg like me to fit into, right? And podcasts are a thing that gave so much power to a lot of people like me. Like, for example, Mark Maron is another perfect example. Like, he was out there doing small room comedy for years and years and years, but network executives were just like, you're too abrasive, you're too neurotic, you're too problematic. You would not fit into a nice little stereotypical role that most Americans in Iowa would get. And, you know, what had happened to both of us is we started these podcasts where it was all about, no, drop the mask, drop the act, just be yourself, don't worry at all about whatever corporate entity has to say, and let's get real. Now that we have this space where no one gets to tell us what we can or can't say, let's see how real we can get. Both of our podcasts have done that, and people love them for that. People flock to them more and more, you know, each month and each year, because they're like, wow, here's a place where people are talking in a way that you just don't feel like you get to hear all the time in the mass media. So, yeah, I think podcasts have been incredibly empowering to a lot of artists. You know, it kind of pisses me off sometimes when I hear stand-up comedians today make fun of podcasts. You know, people make jokes like, "Bo, you have a podcast?" Yeah, who doesn't?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, dude. I mean, your podcast is going to be as unique as you make it. Like, it's going to be as good as you're willing to put the effort and talent and smart into making it. So don't poo-poo the form. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And I've heard so many people say that. And even when people that I just randomly run into that I haven't seen in years will say, "Oh, so you have a podcast?" I'm like, well, yeah, I have a podcast. And they do kind of give it that, "Oh, well, everybody has a podcast." It's like, yeah, but we've also been doing it for 2 years. We've talked to a lot of great entertainers. We've learned a lot. And it kind of, it makes me sad when I do hear, you know, a stand-up or any other entertainer that does kind of poo-poo on the podcast format, because it truly is, it's a new art form. And I think a lot of entertainers miss the fact that, you know, you really can learn just a ton from every podcast out there.
Oh, absolutely. You know, YouTube is very, very similar. Like, you know, I mean, now it's a lot more than YouTube. It's, you know, there are all kinds of places where you can put up a video, like Vimeo and whatever, Hulu, I guess. But, you know, it really put the power into people being creative and making video however they wanted. And listen, even, you know, it's not as if the populace always chooses the best videos to go viral, you know? I mean, there's no predicting sometimes what's going to really hit. But if someone is making amazing YouTube videos for years on end, you know, they're probably going to start getting some attention, I really do think that those do-it-yourself formats like podcasting and YouTube have been just huge shifts. And I think that the TV and the film industry are now really reacting to that. You know, like they're realizing, oh my gosh, there's a lot of talent out there, and there's a lot of people expressing themselves that are building their own audiences, and we should check out what they're doing. You know, like for example, Maron now has a TV show. And I think that, you know, that's not at all surprising, you know, that, you know, someone like IFC, some network executive at IFC is like, holy cow, he's already got X many people listening to his podcast. So there is an audience out there, which we might not have seen if he had just come in and auditioned for us or pitched us, you know.
Yeah, and that's even what, when Pete Holmes was on the show, Pete had mentioned when he and Conan had initially pitched the Pete Holmes show to TBS, that was kind of even their pitch is, you know, he already has, you know, 500 hours of interviews. He already has, you know, some of these YouTube things. We just need somewhere to put it. The show's already made.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, yeah, I think it's very exciting, and I think it will continue to grow. You know, that you know, there's no sign that podcasts are becoming less popular. You know, like there are some things that apparently get to a tipping point and then, you know, stop becoming quite so popular. Like they say that Twitter is kind of like plateauing right now, but I really do think that podcasts are so dynamic and that so much exciting stuff is happening in the podcast realm that I really do think it's going to keep growing and growing.
Yeah, I absolutely think it will, especially when, you know, like you said, even with Maron, I mean, people may have discovered the show on IFC and didn't even realize that he had a podcast, and that turned them on to podcasting. And I mean, there's so many different realms that it's now reaching, where I know people that have watched Comedy Bang Bang didn't realize that that was also a podcast. And there's so many different outlets that it's now kind of reaching across. And I mean, even Chris Hardwick, a lot of people, you know, have only discovered him with At Midnight or The Talking Dead and have turned around and been like, holy shit, there's over, you know, 700 episodes of Nerdist. And they just kind of lose their mind.
Right.
So, I think Hardwick's even a good example where I know, you know, same kind of thing where he kind of felt like he was at his wit's end and started Nerdist, and it's like, I mean, you look at what that's even flourished into now, where, you know,
oh my God,
owned by Legendary.
Yeah, I mean, oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he is now so busy that, you know, he's one of those people where I'm not sure how exactly he does it. I mean, yeah, I'm getting really, really, really busy. We're doing it Risk in 2 to 3 different cities out of town per month now.
Oh, wow.
Plus, the New York and Los Angeles show happen every month. The New York show is getting, the house is going to be 3 or 4 times bigger now. We're moving to a much bigger house. And, you know, I'm having to kind of like hire some people to delegate some of the work that I do on the show to other people. So everything here is expanding too, you know. Really, you know, a lot of people are unsure how one can make money with a podcast. And I always say, you got to have many streams. You know what I mean? Like, because the podcast itself is free, people are going to expect it to be free for the most part. Once you build up archives, you can make the back catalog for charge. You know, once you've done, you know, if you have like 100 episodes for free and the rest for pay, and you know, that you can get away with that. Can get advertisers. There's more and more advertisers coming into the podcast game. You can do live shows outside of places like New York and Los Angeles and actually make some money from them. But also, I started a school, which is the Story Studio. It's at thestorystudio.org. And the deal with that was, in helping people prepare their stories to share on Risk, I realized that oh my God, there is so much value in coaching people to shape their narratives. It helps people who feel like they are too shy, have no social skills, want to learn how to loosen up on a date or just a cocktail party. It helps people who are performers and want to, you know, start expressing themselves more just in any realm of entertainment. And it helps people who are worried about the communication skills in their careers, you know, like when someone is preparing for a job interview or a performance review or a client lunch or a staff meeting where they have to get up and say something. It's all incredibly valuable to have been coached on how to put together a good story and have an emotional trajectory and get scenic, have some actual felt experience happening in there. So, yeah, the risk, my business has become Risk and the Story Studio, teaching, you know, corporate workshops and selling videos of, you know, workshops online. And so, yeah, it's there's various revenue streams in order to keep this whole thing running.
So I love that you do that, the story element with it, because, I mean, there's so many, as I've talked to different comedians, and especially here in Salt Lake, there's not a ton of opportunity for improv and things like that. Whereas I've traveled, you know, made a day trip driving to LA, did a class at Groundlings and drove all the way back. Where it was just something where, you know, I had to be able to keep growing that muscle. And I've told so many comics and people that I'll talk to, you know, it helps you in not just the aspect of being on stage, but where you know, you talk about the business presentations and that. Where learning how to be able to tell a story, learning how to improv, and learning how to structure that just right. I mean, it has just, you know, innumerable impacts on what you can really do with it.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely right. Classes like storytelling and improv especially are techniques that you can keep practicing for years and years. You know what I mean? It's like telling stories and just improvising, you know, having interesting interactions with people that, you know, where you keep forwarding the conversation, forwarding the action, keeping, you know, yes-anding, all that.
Yeah.
These are things that you get better and better at with time. I always, you know, I took improv classes when I was, for the first time, I went through, you know, like five levels of improv classes officially when I was 37 years old. You know, by that time, I had been on television plenty, and I had done plenty of stage shows before. But I wanted to, like, to establish for myself and for a lot of my students to whom I taught sketch comedy, you're never too old to be workshopping. You're never, you know, this stuff is like martial arts. It's like you've got to keep those muscles working in a certain way so that they don't get rusty. And, you know, there's another thing about storytelling is there really are some art forms where you really have to be born with a base level of talent. You know, like not as, you know, what's his name? Plácido Domingo used to try to pitch that he could teach anyone to be an opera singer. And I remember Pavarotti just laughing at that. because obviously not everyone can learn how to become an opera singer. But pretty much everyone can learn how to tell a pretty good story. And we, the audience, if we sense that someone is not a practiced performer, that someone does not get up and do improv classes once a week or get up and do stand-up a couple times a week, we don't care. Because if the person is being really honest and really kind of opening up and they're really kind of authentically walking that high wire of not being too self-indulgent and not being too self-deprecating, but like trying to get to the truth of some real experience that they have real feelings about, we are going to care. You know what I mean? We're going to lean forward, even if you're not able to get up and speak like, you know, Sir John Gielgud. Like, if a person gets up on the stage at risk, and we can tell they're nervous, and we can tell that they're not, you know, they haven't studied, voice training and whatever, it doesn't matter. Because if they're talking about, yeah, I was in this car accident, and I accidentally killed three people, we're going to hear that they're starting to cry, or that they're, you know, really getting to some truth of their experience, and we're going to goddamn care. So, you know, these sorts of classes, learning how to tell stories a little bit more consciously, learning how to, like, bring key details in, and learning how to, like, make sure you stick on a particular emotional trajectory, and kind of fill in the context of your motivations, and what you think was going on inside other characters, all that kind of stuff. Anyone can learn how to do that. And taking workshops is a way you can just continue to get better at it. So, yeah, I believe in it very, very passionately.
Yeah, and especially within the story building. I'll never forget when I was reading UCB's improv manual. And it got to a point where so much I had always, I kind of felt like a know-it-all starting off on improv. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's the whole yes and. And then they had a bit where they mentioned, you know, once you get past the establishment and the base reality, you know, it kind of switches from the yes and into the if then. So if that's true, then what else? And it was like the light bulb kind of went off on, oh, that's storytelling. Like it's being able to build and realize where to heighten the story. And just that little bit of, you know, very basic improv completely changed the way that I viewed storytelling.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, one of the things about workshops also is, even if it's just a one-on-one, like I do a lot of one-on-one training with people over Skype, to get someone else's feedback, someone who actually thinks about storytelling a lot, and it might be other people in a class, like, for example, when I go and teach a corporate workshop, oftentimes they'll just be like, oh, we just want you to give a keynote speech. And I'll insist. I'll be like, no, I really want to get people at least pairing off and trying something with their partner. Even if it's just for like 5 minutes that the person would turn to the person in the seat next to them and try telling a story. I really do feel that forcing people to like take a stab at it is... it's just, you know, nothing compares to actually trying it out and getting some initial feedback from someone who is also thinking about these same things, you know, getting some, you know, a person who's just been hearing this lecture about, for example, you know, including more of the five senses in your stories, is going to be able to say, hey, you know, at one point you said the gist of what someone was trying to communicate, but you could use your voice to imitate how they sounded and what the look in their eyes was like, you know, and that can be hugely helpful to get that kind of feedback.
Absolutely, and that's, I'm just about done with Second City's writing course, and with the class that I'm in right now, Our teacher makes it a point where it's something that's required that every single person has to give at least two people in the class feedback on their pitches and feedback on the synopsises that they're writing, because it's so invaluable to get that feedback that, you know, you think that you have told the perfect story, and then you're able to get that person that says, well, have you thought of it this way? And that has been so helpful, at least for me. That I love that's something that you've brought to that, instead of just wanting to be the keynote speaker, to turn it around and say, yeah, let's make more out of this.
Well, another thing that I also really encourage people, and this comes from my time in the state, is that if someone gives you feedback, and in your gut, you know, in your instinctive, just like, you know, deep down feeling, you're like, really, really, really want to keep that part in, or I just feel like maybe I just didn't word it quite right, but I still feel like that's really important to why I did what I did, you know, that kind of thing. To stick with it, to stick with your gut, you know, like I always say, take what
is useful to you, and believe what you know you really don't believe in. Because that's how workshopping works best. You know, the people in the famous Iowa writers' workshops complain that things get watered down when people take what the committee thinks, what the rest of the room thinks, too seriously. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that you're focus grouping yourself. But getting reactions, just immediate reactions from people who have all these same thoughts in mind, can be helpful as long as you don't feel like anyone's got the gospel truth, you know?
Absolutely. So now with having done this now, you know, going on 7 years, what do you feel is the greatest thing that you've taken away from it after so many episodes and so many people getting up and telling their stories?
Well, you know, what was so refreshing about it for me when I started was I was thrilled. First of all, you know, it's really funny. One thing to keep in mind, if you're a creative person, or really, actually, if you're putting together any kind of career, because nowadays, people, you know, more and more and more people kind of put together careers that are, they do a little bit of this, they do a little bit of that, they have some experience with this, they have some experience with that, and, you know, it's not such an easy trajectory of climbing up a corporate ladder from this position to that position. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so it takes some people, like it took me, until I didn't start Risk until I was 39. And there was definitely a part of my psyche that was thinking, you're going to be 40. You have got to find it. So there was definitely like a part of me that was like, I've got to find it. But when I tried storytelling, true storytelling for the first time, it was at a show at UCB Theater in Chelsea, a show created by Margot Lightman and Julia Rudzi called Strip Stories. I tried telling a true story there for the first time, and I was afraid of all of those things that I had learned to be afraid of from the auditioning process. You know, whenever I go into an audition, I think, oh, fuck, they're going to think I'm too gay, or, ooh, I shouldn't let too much, you know, I shouldn't make jokes that show how absurdist I can be, because they probably want someone who's kind of toned down here, or, oh, gosh, you know, my kinkiness that people might know me from this routine I've done kind of clashes with how polite and friendly and Midwestern I can seem at times. You know, like, all that worry that goes into your head in the auditioning process, I learned in storytelling to let go of it. That first night I told a true story on stage at Strip Stories, I knew that Strip Stories was all stories about sexual situations. So I thought, all right, why don't I take a risk? Because Michael Ian Black had actually advised me, look, why don't you drop the act and take a risk and, like, start being yourself on stage telling your own true story. So I was like, all right, I'll give it a shot. So I decided to tell a story about the first time I prostituted myself when I was, 22 years old. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is super risky because people don't often talk about getting paid for sex. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is what if the theater is mostly, like, frat jocks or something like that, you know, Republicans or something like that. I was just getting all nervous about, I'm going to seem too gay, I'm going to seem too Midwestern, I'm going to seem too absurdist. I got up and did the story. I was all those things. I was to this, to that, and to the other. But they loved it anyway. And I learned that true storytelling is a place where there is a tremendous amount of freedom to go from saying something that's really hilariously funny to saying something that's devastatingly sentimental or seriously heartfelt or spiritual, or starting a story that's really like, oh, I don't know, like seems rather, you know, gritty and tough, and then ends on something that's just, like, completely traumatic. You know, like you can go to humanity or your psyche in a true story, because we inherently understand that real people are not like characters on TV shows, that real people actually have a lot more to them than just telling funny jokes. You know what I mean? When we go to see someone do stand-up, if you don't know who that person is, the audience often has their arms crossed and is thinking, all right, make me like you and make me laugh every 8 seconds for a half hour, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
But if you go to a true storytelling show, the audience has a more open attitude. What they want to know is not that you're going to be any one way from moment to moment. They just want to know that you're telling the truth. So if you start off being completely hilarious and then just, you know, it's all a devastating story about your husband's death or something like that, and, you know, you're crying by the end, everyone's just as happy as if, you know, they would be if you were a stand-up comedian that was keeping them laughing every 8 seconds. So I found it incredibly freeing to find this form where I could be serious and spiritual and kinky and just all the parts of myself that I am. Of course, I love comedy. I love, you know, if I had the chance to, if the state reunited and we were to do, you know, another TV series, I'd be all over that. I'd enjoy the hell out of that. But my truest passion has become this art form, this true storytelling art form, where really anything goes, you know? And I think that the fans of the Risk podcast, they're constantly expressing the same thing. They love the way that in any given episode of the show, or in any given night of the live show, it will go from, you know, someone pooping their pants while tripping on acid, you know, during their trip to the White House, and it's laugh, 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 to a story about, you know, someone having a psychotic breakdown and trying to kill their mother, you know? People love that emotional roller coaster ride that Risk is, and they really get, you know that a Risk fan, like a Risk fan will always express that they get that it's different from other storytelling shows in that will encourage you to say stuff that you could not say on NPR. You know what I mean? That,
right.
That we really are all about, no, anything. I mean, I do say anything goes on the show, but that's not exactly true because I am the curator. I do, you know, I don't put maybe 60% of what we record on the podcast. Sometimes stuff is just not, I feel like, that's just not different enough from stuff we've already heard. Sometimes it's where I felt like, I feel like the person really could have dug a little bit deeper. You know, I felt like they were hiding something. And then sometimes someone will say something that's actually kind of mean-spirited, or it's kind of clear that they've got an agenda. Like, I want to tell the story about my fucked up, you know, ex-husband. You know what I mean? Where it's like, a story that is aimed at, you know, hurting someone else. So I'll be clear. I'll be careful about steering around some of that. But I also have to be careful about being too careful, because I'll tell you one thing. We get trigger warning complaints almost a weekly basis. There's always someone who's like, oh my God, I was so offended that you actually thought it was okay to put this on the podcast, Dan. You know, there's only so much. I mean, if there's a big outcry and I'm like, oh, God, damn, yeah, I guess I actually do see these people's point, then I might, you know, re-go over something. But that's very, very rare.
And you can tell, too, I mean, with this format, you know, reading reviews that fans have written of the show, you know, how much it really does impact people with this form of storytelling. I mean, where there's reviews where people have said, you know, help my 18-year-old stepson stop doing drugs, and, you know, shocked me into being human again. And I think that's something that, you know, a lot of podcasts, as great as they are, they don't necessarily touch that piece of the human psyche where people are able to kind of stop and think and relate and kind of enjoy the human experience more on a real level than just, like you said, you know, where at a stand-up comedy club. You know, people do sit back. I mean, I've seen plenty of them where they sit back and fold their arms, and it's, you know, dance, clown. I'm here for you to prove yourself to me. And this really is a lot more of just reality.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I mean, there are also some stand-up comedians who are very good at veering into, at switching gears from jokes into something more narrative, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Carlin and Pryor especially come to mind. One of my favorite moments in stand-up comedy ever is Richard Pryor Live at the Sunset Strip.
I own the DVD. It is my favorite.
Yeah, he had within the past however many months, he had had his terrible accident with freebasing and all, you know, blew himself up practically,
yeah,
with cocaine and whatever else. But anyway, so he was off the scene for a while, and Live at the Sunset Strip was his return to doing a live show after all this time away, after his big, terrible accident. And he comes out, and for the first 5 minutes, he tells a few jokes. And the audience starts laughing, and then he finally says something, I don't know verbatim what it is, but it's something like, all right, we're all a little bit nervous about how I'm going to do and about how you're going to do tonight. Let's just take a deep breath because we're here now and we're going to go through it. It's like an amazing moment of just getting really real with the audience. And there's just a huge sigh of relief that, you know, he's acknowledged that, yeah, you know, he's going to have to talk about some very real stuff during the course of this concert.
It's honestly something that I've started to respect a lot more, because I have seen a lot of comics that start doing that, where they'll start off kind of with some of the self-deprecating jokes, and then they do move into more of the storytelling jokes. We just had Julian McCullough on the podcast last week, and a lot of his was even kind of like that, experiencing, you know, growing up in San Francisco and kind of what he learned throughout those times. And it was a lot more interesting to kind of take it from that storytelling standpoint and then trickling in those jokes. So I think
yeah,
it helps you get that laugh and then still be able to relate on the human level.
I totally feel that way. You know, I will often start a show with a very funny story of my own, and to kind of make people feel, and it'll usually be like a kinky story. So it being both funny and very sexually revealing will make people feel like, oh, okay, this is a safe place. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then it's okay to kind of shift gears into traumatic stuff or whatever it might be. I think that there's something to be said about peppering in humor without feeling married to it in storytelling. You know, I was at an event where I talked to Louis C.K. at this event recently, and I was telling him about Risk, and he was like, oh my God. He's like, maybe I can do that sometime, but I just get so uncomfortable in a pure storytelling situation, because he's like, all my muscle memory is about reaching for the joke. And so often in a real story, there'll be a long stretch where a joke is just not appropriate, you know, where there'll be a stretch of a story about a divorce or, you know, a failure or whatever it might be, where, you know, it's really much more appropriate just to let it be a sad or sick or fucked up thing that it is, you know what I mean? And a lot of stand-up comedians have so much experience on stage jumping from joke to joke, that it's a little bit of a weird adjustment. But, you know, I am absolutely sure that he could do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Louis, I don't think would have any problem doing it. But at the same time, I totally get what he means, where when you've been doing comedy so long, a lot of people that kind of have that comedy side of them, the comedy comes as almost a security blanket at a lot of the times.
Yeah,
and I think that's
why
you get that story going and you're like, I need a joke somewhere in here and just so that I feel safe again.
Yes, exactly.
So, well, before I let you go here, Kevin, I do have to fanboy for just a second because it's very rare that I ever get to talk to somebody that I honestly feel like had a huge impact in the career path that I ultimately chose, because the state, when I first started and decided I was going to go start writing sketch comedy, the state was a huge part of that decision because I absolutely loved everything that the state did. And I even started going back through and I knew you were coming on and I was like, I need to rewatch, you know, some of the state. I haven't watched it in a while. And for the last 48 hours I have had, you always gave me a boner stuck in my head. So,
yeah, it's funny. That song comes from when we were still in college. You know, that song comes from just little shows that we would do in the dorm room or in the dorm, you know, hall at our college at NYU. So yeah, I know the stage. One of the things that I think was so special about the state is it was a little rare at that particular juncture. You know, the early '90s. For there to be much of a chance on network television, well, you know, that was MTV, but you know, on a corporate sort of television network,
yeah.
For a group to really express itself according to its own internal chemistry and sense of humor, you know, there was definitely Kids in the Hall. I mean, they, it seemed like, were also, like, they were creating comedy that was very much on their page. You know, we're going to make comedy on our page, and you have to get on the same page with us. The state was also like that. And then after us came Mr. Show. So those three groups, I feel, in the early 90s, were really important for showing people how important it is to remember what Python did, to remember that a corporate sketch comedy show like Mad TV or Saturday Night Live is almost by its very design going to have to be focus grouped, going to have to go jump through all kinds of the hoops that anything related to a corporation has to go through. And back in that day, in the early 90s, the writers didn't even really communicate with the actors on Saturday Night Live. They were on different floors, and they often weren't working together at that particular juncture. So, you know, the state, I think, helped remind people, along with Kids in the Hall, No, it's very important to let the actors also write and be friends and have their own chemistry and, like, do stuff that maybe the network executives just don't even get, but other kids their age are going to get, you know, or just people who have a certain sensibility and savvy are going to start getting, you know. The tragedy of the state is that, unlike Risk, we didn't last long enough for more and more people to discover us and get on our page. You know, we should have been there at MTV for another 5 seasons. They actually offered it to us, and we stupidly walked away. But we kind of shot our own career in foot, really, when you get down to it. But if we had lasted, you know, another 5 seasons or so, I think more and more people would have been like, I'm getting this.
Yeah.
You know, the best comedy is often stuff that you have to kind of get used to. You kind of got to get into it. It might be a little confusing to you at first. You have to sort of get into the groove of it before you're like, okay, I'm hearing this, you know? Like, it's the way you have to hear, like, a John Coltrane song a few times before you're like, I'm following this.
Absolutely, but I can definitely say, I mean, I've learned a lot from the state, and you know, truly thank you for making that, because it's honestly, it's been something for me that really was, in a way, life changing.
Oh, awesome! That's so great to hear. Well,
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, and I look forward to seeing you. I know you're going to be at the Urban Lounge here December 12th. Do you already know who you have on the show for that?
No, I don't. In fact, I haven't even started reading the pitches, so be sure and spread the word. Let people know.
So we'll be able to spread out this episode, too, a little, because I know you have the show at Nerd Melt on the 28th of this month, and we definitely want to get this out to everybody in L.A., too, so that they can get out to that show as well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. We are at the Nerdist Showroom in L.A. on the 28th, so seeing that night is bewildering. In Salt Lake City, we'll be there on December 12th, the theme is Twisted, and for that show, we're still taking pitches. So if anyone in Salt Lake or near Salt Lake has a good story that the word twisted comes to mind for, just pitch me at kevin@risk-show.com.
All right, perfect. Well, yeah, we'll get the word out. We'll get this in a bunch of the Salt Lake City groups and everything, and get people paying attention, know that the show's coming, and get those stories into you to, you know, help build just a fantastic show out here.
That's awesome.
So excellent. Well, thank you again so much, Kevin. So I really look forward to meeting you when you're out here.
Indeed. That'll be great. All right, I'll talk to you then.
All right, we'll see you, Kevin. Thank you.